Now we look to our brother Carl Parry to speak to us on O Assyria, the Rod of My Anger.
Thank you, Brother Chairman, my dear brethren, sisters and young people. In Isaiah chapter 10, we really have a change in the mood of the prophecy. In fact, chapter 10 is a rather pivotal chapter in which the turn and tide of battle will now change dramatically. Up to this point, there has been judgment and woes upon Judah for their evil and for their faithlessness, epitomized, of course, in Ahaz. But you see, the whole problem of the Assyrian invasion was to raise many moral questions in the mind of a faithful remnant. Why does God allow evil nations like Assyria to come in and to destroy the people of God? Is God part of that evil? Is it righteous for God to do so? Will he destroy the righteous with the wicked? And all of those questions would have been foremost in the mind of this very small remnant. And therefore, brothers and sisters, God is now going to address the remnant. It was now time to instruct them and to tell them exactly what his purpose was with Assyria, why he was doing it, and how he would eventually punish Assyria. The chapter itself was most likely written after Assyria had in fact taken Samaria. We learn that in verse 9. Is not Samaria as Damascus? So therefore we have a relatively recent prophecy. Most likely the Assyrian forces were at some point on their way to Jerusalem, or maybe even advancing through the land of Judah. We don't know specifically. But clearly the Assyrian was there. And the threat of absolute decimation was clearly palpable before all Judah. We saw in our last class, didn't we, that there was specifically a form of hope given, that the tide of the Assyrian river would stop at the neck. There would be some salvation. And now Isaiah is going to tell the remnant exactly what they must do in the face of this invasion. Well, here it is in verse 5, as the margin correctly says, "Woe to the Assyrian." It was now time for the cycle of God's judgments to move from the woes of Judah to now afflict the Assyrian himself. Woe to Asher, the rod of God's anger. The staff in their hand is my indignation. So here's the real reason why Assyria is to invade. It's simply a rod of chastisement and correction. And God does that. As a token of his love towards his people, he chastises them as he does us. And despite the fact that it was wielded in anger, it was nevertheless to inflict pain for a brief period of time only. God was holding the staff. He was in control of the events. And there's therefore an immediate consolation for the remnant that this was no indiscriminate invasion. It was in full control by God. God had held the rod in his hand and was inflicting the punishment. But it was measured. It was not out of control. God was firmly holding the rod. Verse 6, God says, "I will send him against an hypocritical nation." The Hebrew is a polluted nation. Not so much hypocritical as polluted. To take a spoil and to take a prey. That's the meaning of Maha Shalal Hashbaz. Remember that we saw? Speeding to the spoil, hasting to the prey. But now there's a change in the meaning of Maha Shalal Hashbaz's name. We saw in our last study that in fact that name was given as a name of hope that God would remove the power from Damascus and Samaria and give the spoil to the Assyrian. But now it's turned a full circle. And the name of Maha Shalal Hashbaz was now to be a name of judgment for Judah, as God would now take their prey and take their spoil. But does Assyria know what it's doing? Is Assyria conscious of the fact that they are being wielded by God? Of course not. And hence verse 7, "Howbeit he meaneth not so, neither doth his heart think so. He's not cooperating with God. He's not implicated in God's plan. He doesn't know anything about it. But in his heart is to destroy and to cut off nations, not a few. His motive is altogether different from the way God is using him. In his heart, it is to destroy and cut off nations, not a few. His main mission was plunder and conquest and pillage on a global scale. So how does God control nations? And at what point does God in fact change the use of nations to further his purpose and then punish them? If we come back to Deuteronomy, we have a remarkable quotation to show the foresight of the providence of God. Deuteronomy 32. God in control, most definitely. In Deuteronomy 32 and verse 8, Moses says, when the Most High divided to the nations their inheritance, when he separated the sons of Adam, he set the bounds of the people according to the number of the children of Israel. Now, what an amazing concept that is. What Moses is saying is that as the flood dissipated from the earth and the sons of men began to disperse themselves amongst the world, the providence of God marked out the boundaries of those nations and limited the expansion to but 70 nations. And why did he do that? Because many, many, many hundreds of years later, he would give the children of Israel 70 people as their inheritance. Now, you think about the equation and balance of that. It wasn't so much the nations just sporadically spreading themselves across the globe in a higgledy-piggledy fashion. It was the very measured and controlled providence of God which set their boundaries and established an exact number and gave the earth as an inheritance to man, though they deserved it not, and limited their expansion and their number. Can you imagine the control required for that? The organisation of boundaries, the interaction of all of these different people and families until at last there were 70. Because many, many years later, he would limit the expansion of the sons of Israel to 70 members of the family. And there was a balance of Jews and Gentiles. What he gave to the Gentiles, he gave to the Jews. That's a remarkable foresight and forethinking and balance in the way that God operates. He determines the boundaries. In Proverbs 21... we have this interesting figure of speech used in the providence of God. As Brother Robert said, in the ways of providence, man has free will, a voluntary expression of free will. Therefore, how does God organize and arrange and manipulate nations without interfering with their free will? Well, in Proverbs 21 and verse 1, we read this. The king's heart is in the hand of Yahweh. He can read the thoughts. He knows people's motives. He knows their ambitions and he knows their desires. The king's heart is in the hand of Yahweh. As the rivers of water, he turns it whithersoever he will. Now, you think about a river. It starts in the hills and meanders down through the vales and finally becomes a very large river. And how do you control a river? Well, you put a block there, don't you? Water finds its own level. If you put a great boulder at the source of the stream, it will go round. Put another boulder there, it will go somewhere else. And it can be diverted by obstacles. And God does that. When I was doing history at school, not too many years ago, we learnt about history in a very mechanical sort of way. Cause and effect. Cause and effect. The French Revolution was caused by this and caused by that. And really, although it's a very mechanistic and mechanical way of doing it, it really is the way in which God works. He will use things like famine and prosperity and drought and tornado and hurricane and the level of the seas and all those kind of things in a very skillful combination of things to produce effects on people's hearts. For example, If you have a drought lasting for 10 years, you can detect the mood of the people. You can control the mood of the people. And God does that. Obstacle here, obstacle there. Without interfering with man's free will, knowing their ambitions, and using those ambitions to channel his purpose. An amazing thing. Even the archangels themselves find that a challenge, as we know from Daniel. It took a few days to work out the way in which the king would actually move in a certain direction. But when a nation exceeds the bounds of propriety, then God will turn and punish those ambitions. For example, as we saw in one of our readings this week, God rewarded Nebuchadnezzar with wages for pursuing his purpose. He took Jerusalem. It was a rather humane invasion, if I may use that figure of speech. And as a result, God said, I will give you Egypt as wages. But as soon as Nebuchadnezzar went past the bounds of propriety, is not this great Babel that I built, then the watchers and the holy ones who are keeping a very close tab on the ambitions of nations step in. Nebuchadnezzar lost his throne, kingdom, 7 years. And so it is with Assyria when we come back to Isaiah chapter 10. The ambitions and greed of Assyria, God channeled. But you see, they went much further than that charge. Much further than the charge. The arrogance of this power began to manifest itself. Verse 8. Are not my princes altogether kings? Every time they conquered a city, the general that took the city became the king of that city. Fast track to promotion. Is not Calno in verse 9 as Carchemish? Calno. Calno was the Calne of Genesis chapter 10, verses 10 and 11. It was the beginning part of Nimrod's kingdom. Assyria got it back. There was boastfulness and aggression and spite in this invasion. And then in verse 10, there's a religious scorn introduced. As my hand hath found the kingdoms of the idols, and whose graven images did excel them of Jerusalem and of Samaria, shall I not, as I have done unto Samaria and her idols, so do to Jerusalem and her idols? He was absolutely right. I mean, they had a very cynical approach towards idols and religions. Very cynical, because all of these gods proved absolutely worthless and useless in the event of the invasion. Highly cynical, as we are against the idols of the world, because they're nothing. But he made the fatal mistake of equating the God of Jerusalem with the same powerlessness as the idols of other cities, and there was his mistake. There was his mistake. He passed the bounds of propriety. The ambition and the evil was now on such a grand scale that God could no longer ignore that. And the holy ones and the watchers were now to step in and to punish that man. How did Assyria even arise? When you read Isaiah chapter 10, there's this supreme arrogance and disdain for everything. In 2 Kings chapter 19, just get your hand in Isaiah, in 2 Kings 19, God very casually explains how Assyria had in fact achieved its prominence. This was God's reply to Rabshakeh. Was it because Assyria was powerful and all-conquering? Well, that's how the Assyrian felt. But God said, in verse 26, 2 Kings 19, therefore their inhabitants were of small power. They were dismayed and confounded. They were as the grass of the field, as the grass of the herb, as the grass upon the housetops, as corn blasted before it grows up. And I know thy abode, and thy going out, and thy coming in, and thy rage against me. And what he's saying is this: the only reason why the conquest ever happened was because I deliberately placed within the region of the Fertile Crescent the weakest of kingdoms. kingdoms which were of small power. Kingdoms easily dismayed and terrified by your advance. Kingdoms that are just like the grass on the housetops. Isn't that interesting? As Assyria was boasting because it was so superior, and God said, oh, by the way, the reason why you're successful is because the opposition was pathetic. Pathetic. But you see, it fed the ambition of Assyria. So back in Isaiah chapter 10, God says, we've had enough. We've had enough. And verse 12 is one of those little key verses that help us unlock some of the significance of Isaiah. Let's read it carefully. Wherefore, says verse 12, it shall come to pass that when the Lord hath performed his whole work upon Mount Zion and on Jerusalem, I will punish the fruit of the stout heart of the king of Assyria and the glory of his looks. Now we are introduced to a concept here which is styled God's whole work. In Isaiah 28, it's expressed like this. Just come across to Isaiah 28. Here it is in verse 21. Isaiah 28. For Yahweh shall rise up as in Mount Perazim. He shall be wroth as in the valley of Gibeon, that he may do his work, his strange work, and bring it to pass, his act, his strange act. There was a purpose and point about this whole drama that was unknown to the majority of Israel. And what was that work, brothers and sisters? The Assyrian invasion was just part of the process. What was this work? What was this strange work that he had to do? Well, the answer is found in Isaiah chapter 4. Because it involves the preservation of a remnant in a special way. Isaiah chapter 4 and verse 3. Unfortunately, we haven't dealt with that in our studies, but let's read this verse. It shall come to pass that he that is left in Zion and he that remaineth in Jerusalem, so we're talking about people who are left, the remnant, shall be called holy, even everyone that is written among the living in Jerusalem. When the Lord shall have washed away the filth of the daughters of Zion, and shall have purged or cleansed the blood of Jerusalem from the midst thereof, by the spirit of judgment and by the spirit of burning. Now there is God's work, and it is this. That it was, brethren and sisters, the preservation and the interest of a remnant that God was interested in. And he would preserve and produce cleanness and holiness and faithfulness in that remnant, as the end of verse says, by the spirit of burning and the spirit of judgment. That's his work. And in the end, it will be so successful that at the end of verse 3, it will be like writing their names among the living in Jerusalem, the survivors in Jerusalem. Their names would be written in heaven. There's his work. That's what he was doing. It was expressed by Paul in the New Testament that through much tribulation, much thlipsis, much pressure, we shall enter the kingdom of God. That's why. That was his strange work. And the Assyrian invasion was just part of that. That produced the pressure. That produced the way in which the remnant would eventually manifest faith. As you know, brothers and sisters, God works in exactly the same way today. Pressure, pressure, pressure. It's not to crush us or to destroy us. It's to produce in us faith and trust and to write our names in the book of life. That's what it's all about. And the God who worked in Isaiah chapter 10 is the same God who works with us today in similar methods. And we can say, brothers and sisters, that the Assyrian invasion was no picnic. It was real, it was brutal, it was evil, it was malicious. The pressure was altogether real. And so it is today. It is altogether real. At times we face horrendous problems, personal or ecclesial, individual. But our faith may also be tested. And that is, brethren and sisters, the work of God today. The work of God today is to preserve a remnant through trial, the spirit of judgment and the spirit of burning. At last, the remnant was being told why all this was happening. At last, they could now understand that the reason for all this difficulty was for them. God is for us, Emmanuel. And God says, when that work's finished, and he did produce a remnant. But if we could go on in our studies to talk about the life of Hezekiah and Sennacherib, but to understand the way in which God did produce faith in that people. But when he'd done that, I will punish the fruit of the stout heart of Assyria. And he did. In verses 13 through to verse 15, he talks in the language of sarcasm. Have you ever seen an axe shaking the axe bearer? Of course you haven't. And this arrogance, and this high looks, and this overweening pride was so carefully described. It was like a person going to a nest and stealing the eggs, laughing because no one would ever stop them. And they just went round plundering, a nest here, a nest there, against defenceless nations. And God says, we've had enough. We've had enough. Therefore, in verse 16, shall the Lord, Adonai, Yahweh of armies, look at the phrases there, he who will manifest himself in rulers and armies, he shall send among his fat ones, the Hebrew is men of valor, he shall send among his men of valor leanness. The word is used in Psalm 106, verse 15, to describe the effects of plague. It's exactly what God did. And the plague would burn like a fire. So under his glory he shall kindle a burning like the burning of a fire. It'd be like a huge funeral pyre. We read that in Isaiah 30 during the week. Of this incredible furnace in Tophet, ordained of old for the king. And the description of that chapter describes a great lava flow coming into Jerusalem and burning up this king. And the light in verse 17 of Israel shall be for a fire. The light. We've seen the light, haven't we? Behold, the darkness in Isaiah 9 was to be replaced by the light of Emmanuel. And the same light would be the kindling of that fire. The Holy One of Israel would supply the flame. It's just like the crackling of thorns and thistles. It's like a forest being burnt, says verse 19. The rest of the trees of his forest shall be few, that a child may count them. That's interesting, because when you look at these Syrian monuments, you find there's always a scribe there, counting the number of skulls outside the city, the number of crucifixes, the number of cities destroyed. And God says, I'll do the same. And this time there'll be nothing left, so that even a child can go out and count the few trees that are left and write them down. But it was for the remnant, brethren and sisters, that God was truly interested in. This small group of people for whom he works. It was for them that the chapter was written, to explain to them his purpose and to encourage them to hang on whilst the Assyrian was in the land. Let's read these words in verse 20. It shall come to pass in that day that the remnant of Israel and such as are escaped of the house of Jacob shall no more again stay upon him that smote him. But they shall stay or lean upon Yahweh, the Holy One of Israel, in truth. there was God's work. Now, I want you to notice there are two classes of people in that verse. There is the remnant of Israel and the escaped of the house of Jacob. Two distinct classes. Why is that? Well, the remnant of Israel was the remnant of those in the north of the kingdom, and the escaped of the house of Jacob were those in the south. We've got two distinct remnants. Now, how can that be? I'd like you to come across to 2 Chronicles chapter 30. See, here's the expression used of the remnant of Israel. We saw this yesterday, didn't we, in 2 Chronicles chapter 30 and verse 6, when Hezekiah sent runners up to the north. And halfway through the verse 6 of 2 Chronicles 30, ye children of Israel, turn again unto Yahweh Elohim of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, and he will turn to the remnant of you that are escaped. There is the remnant of Israel. And those people who humbled themselves, diverse of Manasseh, Naphtali, Zebulun, who came down, they were the remnant that had escaped of Israel. And they came down into the Passover. Some went back. When we come to 2 Chronicles 31, some stayed. 2 Chronicles 31 and verse 6. And concerning the children of Israel and Judah that dwelt in the cities of Judah, they also brought in the tithe of oxen and sheep. That's an interesting verse. Because what it's saying is, and you picture this, brothers and sisters, you know, we were impressed at the magnitude and generosity of Hezekiah in going north to those nations up there, apostate to the extreme, a few years before they'd be wiped off the face of the earth. And some came down. And can you imagine? It would have been a difficult circumstance as all these people poured across the border to keep the Passover. They were technically and legally unclean. In fact, Hezekiah had to pray for them in preparation for the Passover. The good Yahweh pardon every one of them that prepares his heart. And Yahweh did forgive those people. And some settled in Judah. They refused to go home. And therefore, the people in Judah had to open their houses in hospitality to receive the remnant that had come from Israel. Imagine that. You know, we read of the Kosovo crisis, some of the Albanians opening their homes to these people pouring across from Kosovo in their thousands. And the same kind of thing would have happened in Judah. The ecclesia opening its houses to welcome their long-lost brethren in. What an amazing situation. And do you know, brothers and sisters, that that verse tells us that these people who came with nothing, who are refugees from the north, who sheltered with those in the south, they also brought in the tithe of the oxen and the sheep. They had very little substance, but they gave it back to God. They were indeed a changed people who'd come from the north. And the little that they had, they gave the 10% back to God to support the teaching of the law in Judah. What an amazing remnant they were. And both of them, the remnant of Israel and the escaped of Judah, dwelling together in the cities of Judah. Now here's the issue. Imagine if you had been somewhere up north and you'd come all the way down, you'd humbled yourself, you'd come to the Passover, you found yourself unable to participate until Hezekiah prayed for your forgiveness, and then for 7 days you received the word of God like you'd never heard before, and you asked one of the people who were with you whether you could stay with them to escape the Assyrian. And now the Assyrian, whom you had fled from in full trust that God would save you, was now once again knocking on your door. You know, God does test faith, doesn't he? Doesn't he test faith? And the people who had come all that way to escape Assyria, trusting that God would deliver them, receiving the joyfulness of the word of God, were now faced with the identical trial again. Can you see how God was purifying and changing these people to trust in him? The trials of life are not easy, but the rewards are abundant if faith can prevail. So let's come back to Isaiah 10. This is the group. These are the people. Brethren, sisters of great caliber, but they desperately need consolation because the Assyrian is on his way. You only have to look at the British Museum and the Lakish inscriptions to understand the brutality of those people. I mean, today they take photographs of the war. In those days, they etched them indelibly in stone, and they were brutal. Brutal. It would have torn the heart of King Hezekiah to see his people torn apart by those people, flayed alive and crucified. And therefore, the only refuge was in the head, in Jerusalem. And thousands of people who sought their life, who refused to fight the Assyrian, knowing that the Assyrian would advance to Jerusalem, sought refuge in that city. If there were any who stayed behind to fight, they would be overwhelmed by that judgment. As I mentioned the other day, the gospel to this generation was to seek redemption in Jerusalem. So God says, back in Isaiah chapter 10 and verse 20, that when this is all finished, they will no longer lean upon him that smote them. And that is a reference to Ahaz's policy. Ahaz hired Assyria and trusted in him, lent upon him, because to Ahaz, Assyria was the salvation of his life. And God says, when I finish with the Assyrian, they will no longer do that anymore, the remnant. They will lean upon Yahweh, the Holy One of Israel, in truth. And that's why in Isaiah 26, the prophet said this. Leaning upon God. Isaiah 26 and verse 3. Thou wilt keep him in shalom, shalom. Peace, peace, perfect peace. Whose mind, or as the margin says, imagination, is stayed, leaning on thee, because he trusteth in thee. Trust ye in Yahweh forever, for in Yahweh is everlasting strength. The record says they leaned upon the words of Hezekiah, and that in turn at last generated a leaning on God. What a wonderful thought that is. You lean upon someone when you are weary and you need support. And you trust that person that they have the strength to give you the support you need. And the prophet says that our imagination, what we think about, what we're interested in, what our priorities are, leans upon Yahweh in absolute trust, because in him there is everlasting strength. And that's the message that we need to learn, as the remnant of those days needed to learn. There is no other strength. And when we are reduced, brothers and sisters, to a situation where there are no human answers, and we're cast upon God, that's when we really learn to lean upon him, because there's no one else to do so. And so it was with the Assyrian invasion. There was no other nation alive that had resisted that power. And they were being asked to believe that God could destroy it. The remnant, says verse 21 of Isaiah 10, shall return. That's the meaning of Shear Jashub's name. Remember Isaiah's first son? The remnant shall return. unto the remnant of Jacob, to the mighty God. Mighty God? That's El Gibor. We saw that expression in Isaiah chapter 9, didn't we? Remember that? The mighty God. They're going to return to the promise of Emmanuel. They're going to believe that God in fact will save them. And the hero that they'll take is God. The mighty God. The everlasting Father. The Prince of Peace. At last they'll turn to him. At last the promise of Emmanuel become a reality. At last God will turn this people from the faithlessness and evil of Ahaz's reign to trust in him. It was never God's purpose. Never God's purpose that all Israel would be faithful. What do we mean by that? Well, you see, verse 22, though thy people Israel be as the sand of the sea. Now that's the phrase of the Abrahamic promise. Thy seed shall be as the sand of the sea. Yes, most certainly, God will multiply many, many, many people in Israel on a natural basis. But you see, God knew, though he wills that everyone will be saved, he knows that though the people of Israel be as the sand of the sea, yet only a remnant of them shall turn. Whilst he blessed Abraham and blessed the children of Israel, and the natural seed of Israel filled the land, God knew that only a remnant would ever fully respond and turn to him. Those words were quoted by Paul in Romans. Let's look at that, shall we, in Romans chapter 9. Verse 27. Isaiah also crieth. It was an appeal, a cry. Though the number of the children of Israel be as the sand of the sea, a remnant shall be saved. But that wasn't what Isaiah said. He said a remnant shall return. But Paul understood exactly what that meant. Returning to God was salvation. Paul says, verse 28 of Romans 9, he will finish the work. The work, there it is again, the work. The work was to produce a remnant. And cut it short in righteousness, because a short work will the Lord make upon the earth. So what was the point? Verse 31, Israel, which followed after the law of righteousness, has not attained to the law of righteousness. Why? Because they sought it not by faith. They stumbled at the stumbling stone, which is Isaiah chapter 8. It is true that God promised the seed of Abraham as the sand of the sea, but he knew that only a remnant would ever respond fully. When we come back to Isaiah chapter 10, The question that would come to the mind of the remnant is, would this invasion by Assyria, would this invasion involve the destruction of the wicked? Was it just an indiscriminate advance of Assyria? Or would God control who was and who wasn't saved? Well, let's read the rest of verse 22. The consumption decreed shall overflow. The invasion's coming, but it is regulated, says the end of verse 22, in righteousness. So when the invasion came, it was not indiscriminate. And the remnant could take great consolation with that. That God was in righteousness bringing that invasion to make sure that the faithful would survive. For in verse 23, Adonai Yahweh of armies shall make a consumption. It's determined. It's in the midst of all the land. But it will be in righteousness. And the remnant can have full confidence that God will not do unjustly in that invasion. So what advice would God give to the remnant? How would you encourage a faithful group of brethren and sisters to hang on? Well, in verse 24, therefore thus saith Adonai Yahweh of armies, O my people, small group of people I've reserved for myself, that dwellest in Zion, be not afraid. They were the same words that Isaiah spoke to Ahaz. Fear not. They were the same words that we saw in a study in chapter 8. Sanctify Yahweh of armies himself. Let him be your fear. Let him inspire you with awe. It's the same message. Don't be afraid. It's the message we saw with Legion, with Jairus' daughter, with the woman with the issue of blood. Is exactly the same. It is a consistent message of consolation by God in the face of adversity and difficulty. Don't be afraid. He shall smite thee with a rod. Yes, there will be discipline. There will be difficulty. But in the end, verse 25, for a very little while, a very little while, but in the end the indignation will cease. It's like Paul's words, for the sufferings that we suffer now, if you put it into a scale of balances, I reckon, he says, that the sufferings of this present age, in this great balance, are not worthy to be compared with the glory that shall be received for eternity. And that really corrects the perspective, doesn't it? Yes, suffering for the present time is grievous. But when weighed against the eternity of God's glory, it's nothing. It's for a very little while. And we need to understand and believe that. A very little while. But in the end, God will save. You imagine if you were one of those people from the north, showing the hospitality of one of those faithful men and women in the south, poring over those words that Isaiah spoke, drawing the consolation and comfort. Yes, there will be discipline, there will be a rod, but in the end, if you can hold on, hold fast, there will be a glorious and wonderful release for the remnant of faith. And it's the same with us. I'm going to finish a few minutes earlier today, which is a bit of a change. I'm not going to go into the latter-day Assyrian, take too long. But let's understand that the exhortation and everything that's done is because at the end of verse 27 of the anointing. The Hebrew is the face of oil. That God was redeeming the remnant because of one man. In Isaiah's day, it was the anointed king, the parable of redemption through Hezekiah. And in the future, it will be because of the Anointed One, Emmanuel himself. Let us take, brothers and sisters, the consolation of this chapter. Let's appreciate that God deals with remnants, small, scattered folk all over the globe who hold fast the truth. And let's learn the lesson to lean upon him in truth. Thou wilt keep him in perfect peace, whose imagination is stayed on him.